You.
Stew.
De.
De.
Ew.
Studio.
That's it.
Right? Studio.
360 with Kurt Anderson.
Kurt Anderson.
Kurt Anderson.
I listen to it on the radio in my car.
Now don't be sniffy about
it. I'm not being sniffy.
I think you are.
No.
You've got a nose for it.
Oh, gosh. Wow. What are you saying over there?
Today on the show,
I'm playing some of his guitar parts, not knowing he's a Native American musician.
Live your life off of what is already inside of you.
No, nudity is much more a concern.
Keep listening. Stay right there. Don't go anywhere. Stay. Sit.
That's Jimi Hendrix, of course. He is a late 60s rock and roll pioneer and African-American. But what people tend to overlook about Jimi Hendrix is that he also strongly identified as Cherokee.
Being part Native was very meaningful to my grandmother.
That's Janie Hendrix, Jimmy's sister.
She talked about that a lot and really instilled that in all of us, but especially Jimmy.
It's really no wonder that the contributions of Native Americans to rock have gone unrecognized. After all, it isn't always obvious from some guitarist or drummer's appearance that he's Chippewa. And some musicians back in the day, worried about discrimination, did not exactly advertise their ancestry. But it turns out that, yes, Native American rock musicians have been influential, musically and otherwise. That influence was the subject of an exhibit at the Smithsonian a few years ago, and is now the subject of a really illuminating documentary called Rumble, The Indians Who Rocked the World. The film was produced by Stevie Salas, a guitar player who has performed all over the world for many years with Rod Stewart, Mick Jagger, George Clinton, and lots more, and he is Apache. Stevie Salas, welcome to Studio 360.
Thanks.
This is such an interesting film. I learned so much. It was also so entertaining to see all the clips of everybody. How long has this been in the works? And the idea sprang from where, how?
Well, really, it's been in the works for most of my life. But what happened was, first, it was just curiosity. I grew up on the beach in San Diego. My father left Wyoming, and my mother's family had left New Mexico, and I never really saw myself as different. And I moved to L.A. in 1985 after high school, and I got a huge gig playing with Rod Stewart. But I would notice that there's just not too many people that look like me. I'd be on tour, and I was in this massive band, playing, five nights at Madison Square Gardens or whatever. But I just didn't see anybody look like me. I just started getting curious. That's also, I started to do a little digging on the subject back then and where people were from.
I want to ask you about this film's director, who is an Anglo woman from Canada named Catherine Bainbridge, all of whose work seems to be movies and TV shows about Native people. So tell me about her. Why is that her professional mission?
Well, it's because she's married to a Cree man from way up in Chisasibi near the Hudson Bay, and her children are Native children. And she's really passionate about the history, and she's really, really good with that stuff.
Well, one great thing about this film is that there are obviously gigantic musicians like Jimi Hendrix that one has knew and has heard of. But some people, a lot of people, a shockingly lot of people who were big deals whom I'd never heard of and were influential. Like, let's start, for instance, with one of your favorites, a guy you mentioned, Link Wray. Here's maybe his most famous track. That was Rumble by Link Wray and his Ray Man in 1957. So what do you love about that?
Well, you know what's really a trip about that is it's the song that first invented really the distorted power chord. You got this distorted thing coming out of the guitar that Pete Townsend is freaking out. That Jeff Beck told me him and Jimmy Page would play air guitar to that song. And so it influenced everybody that influenced me. And Slash talked a lot about that with me because Slash and I kind of came up together. And, all of us guys, we listen to Townsend, Dave Davies, we all listen to Jimmy Page, we all listen to Jeff Beck and Clapton. I mean, those are the guys. And then he says, I was wondering one day, who did they listen to? And he said, the more he dug, the name that always came up was Link Wray. And you realize that this is a massively unsung person.
Yeah, and no, and, you know, okay, we know Chuck Berry. We know some of the farthest, deepest godfathers of rock and roll. But this, to me, it's like, whoa, this is the moment rock is being invented, and this just sounds so hard and unwatered down and cool. And it was amazing to discover who did this.
And that song with no lyrics was banned from radio because it was inciting teen violence. And it's not even any lyrics, right?
Right.
So he's touching a nerve big time, right? So he influences, you know, the people that are the Mount Rushmore of rock, the Townsend, Page, Beck. You know, he gets the big guys. Now they go on, and Link Wray sort of goes off into obscurity to the public.
So did he he influenced you kind of second and third hand through the Jeff Becks and
yes.
So forth? Yeah.
Like most people my age, we didn't even realize, you know, same with Jesse Ed Davis. We didn't realize we were getting influenced by these guys because we had to go back and search who they influenced, and that's when we realized how important they were.
Jesse Ed Davis is a guitarist I'd heard of from liner notes growing up. I had no idea who he was, but the name is familiar because he was on Beatles albums and Eric Clapton albums and Jackson Brown albums and so many others. Here is one of the extremely well-known tracks he played on. Whatever gets you through the night. That is, of course, Whatever Gets You Through the Night by John Lennon with Elton John and Jesse Ed Davis on guitar. Tell the listeners a little something about Jesse Ed.
Well, I was exactly like you, okay? So I used to, you know, I remember the Atlantic Crossing album by Rod Stewart came out, I think, when I was in fifth grade or sixth grade or something like that. And I remember reading the liner notes, and I'd see the song written by Jesse Ed Davis on guitar. I'd see that name everywhere, having no idea he was a Native American man. I then later on would join Rod Stewart's band as my first big band. My first band really joined since high school. And I would learn Jesse Ed Davis guitar parts, not realizing I was learning guitar parts by a Native American man. Uh-huh. Here, while I'm on tour with Rod Stewart searching for Native American musicians, uh-huh. I'm playing some of his guitar parts, not knowing he's a Native American musician. And then later on, you know, we started getting into it. We started to find out, you know, Brad Whitford from Aerosmith goes, you know, I love Jesse Ed Davis. And he's, you know, and I see he would dress like an Indian, but I thought he just dressed like that because he looked cool. I didn't realize he was an actual Native American, you know, which was great. And then Jackson Brown said, yeah, it was, you know, everybody dressed like an Indian then. It was the cool thing to do. Yeah. So you didn't know if he was actually really one, right? And now when I watch the Bangladesh footage with Clapton and George Harrison.
The 1971 concert for Bangladesh, yeah. The big benefit.
And there he is right there. It's got Clapton on one side, and it's got Jesse on his left. And, you know, Jesse was a big, big man. So you got this big, gigantic Native American man standing right next to Clapton and right next to George Harrison. And I'm thinking, how did I not look at that footage my whole life and go, who's that Indian on the stage there?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because it's like so obvious now that you know.
Yes. Well, which is my experience of watching this film in general. It's like, wait, this stuff I've been looking at my entire life, suddenly now, wait, all of these Native Americans stepped out of the shadows that were, and they were just, we were looking at them all the time.
They were right there in plain sight. You know, it's funny, because David Frick is our musicologist, right, for the movie.
He was a Rolling Stone writer, right?
He's the senior editor at Rolling Stone or something like that. He knew everything about this. It was like, oh, yeah. It's like, why didn't anybody tell anybody?
Yeah. Our next track is a guy who might vaguely heard of because I know what I know about the blues. This is Charlie Patton. It is in my pony. I love my black man. That's Charlie Patton playing Pony Blues in 1929, which sounds pretty classic African-American blues to me, but tell me about Charlie Patton and what you hear there, you know?
Well, what you just said is funny, right? Because it's true. We are all brought up to believe that the blues was a black art form. And it wasn't until we started to dig in there, you know, Billy Gibbons said to me one day, you know, Charlie Patton, if you look at him closely, he had some curly, wavy blonde hair. And I'm like, what? And then we started to find those quotes, like from Howlin' Wolf. And those people saying, man, this Native American guy taught me how to play guitar. And you started to realize that what was really going on was the birth of our nation, and music being a byproduct of it, was all these cultures being mixed up. And that's what created the sound and the feeling and the sort of what our country turned into, North America, Canada included.
Well, and there's a great scene in the film that was to me musically revelatory, where you have these Native women in the South singing their Native songs, which sound... And you suddenly, watching that, you suddenly get, oh, I get this connection to the blues.
Yeah, yeah. And you know what? I mean, if I didn't know what the story was, I would just assume they were singing the blues.
Yeah.
It was a black art form. But what we're really trying to say is that it isn't really just a black art form. It is a black art form, a Native art form, and many other cultures that created that. So we're not saying the Indians did it and the black people didn't or whatever. It's all of it together, like a gumbo, like Ivan Neville says in the film.
To me, I think of gumbo, which is the quintessential New Orleans food. When I was growing up, gumbo was you put everything you had in a pot. All that stuff together makes this great meal. I'm part Native American, part African by way of Haiti, part French, part Italian. And that's kind of what New Orleans is. And it comes out so flavorful.
Another thing, when you're talking about the connections between Native music and the blues, is how the playing the guitar like a drum, which again I never thought of. That's an interesting connection as well.
I never thought of that either, man. Catherine really found that stuff and pulled it out and enlightened me as well, because I never really realized that, you know, because when they played, they didn't have the band, right? So the beat on the guitar would be your drum beat, and you'd have your four on the floor is like your powwow. Your powwow beat, then you'd have your polyrhythms, your African polyrhythms mixed in there, you know what I mean? All of a sudden, now it's the sound of the blues, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
I pulled into Nazareth, was feeling about half past dead.
So Robbie Robertson, who has been one of my favorite musicians since I was a teenager and first heard the band and bought every record they ever made, talk about him. He's a big figure in this film.
He's really the Holy Grail, isn't he? I mean, if you think about Robbie Robertson has the muscle as a Native American man to do pretty much what he wants, and he has the cachet. And he was super important, because if he wouldn't have been in the Smithsonian exhibit, it just wouldn't have worked, because... You know, there's always these people that are going to say, like, well, I never heard of Jesse Ed Davis or Link Wray. Come on, you guys are just fishing. But when there's nobody's questioning Robbie Robertson.
Right.
He is beyond a legend. You know, Taylor Hawkins from the Foo Fighters said, you know, Robbie Robertson, everybody wants to be, I want to play in the band, you know.
Yeah. So
he is super important for this film, because he really brought the anchor of credibility.
As you were making this documentary, did you think, okay, this is how I want... non-Native audiences, which will obviously be most of your audience, to see this and come away thinking about it this way, and this is what I want, what I want Native people to see in this film and feel about this film?
Once I turned 40, I said, okay, I've spent the first half of my life really being selfish and, you know, trying to be rich and trying to be famous and all this stuff, which was really fun. I loved it. I've had some great times. But I wanted to go back to Indian country, and I wanted to try to help, because I'd see people beating their heads against the wall. And one of the things I realized was they didn't have a lot of role models. You know, there's not a lot of role models in Indian country other than, you know, history, you know, Geronimo and...
Yeah, Sitting Bull.
Yeah. And so I knew that these musicians would prove that, look, anything is possible. These guys did it, especially in times where you could get killed for it, right? And... I wanted them to have some role models. I wanted us to have role models that were, you know, represented, that were somebody you could be proud of. But then what happened was once Catherine started digging deeper into the history and even the Smithsonian, big time in the Smithsonian, actually, I should say, we started to realize that we were unearthing some history, American history, that never been told, that never was known. We knew the black story with rock and Robert Johnson and Little Richard. We knew the white story with rock and roll when Elvis popped and then the Beatles. But there was a red story we never knew about. And now it's out. And that's something I'm the most proud of, that the film has really rewritten some wrongs. And we're not saying we did this, you didn't do this. We're just saying these guys did this, and it's important.
Right.
And it should be recognized, and it will be recognized from now on. And if I die and that's what the film did, then I'm good with that.
Well, Stevie Salas, you really have, and congratulations for educating me and entertaining me, and I think a lot of all the people who see this film as well. So thank you.
Thank you.
Rumble, The Indians Who Rocked the World, is out now in New York City and opens around the country later this summer. Coming up, the particulars of a sex scene that'll get a movie an R rating instead of a PG-13.
Yeah, it's also the amount of thrusts or humps that's in the scene.
The number?
And, yeah, it can definitely be the prolonged, you know, action of it.
How Howard Friedkin helps filmmakers and studios tweak their movies to get the ratings they want. That's next in Studio 360, PRI and WNYC. I've always been interested in the movie rating system, PG-13 and R and all that. That is partly, I guess, because I was in the micro generation that it really hit hard first. There were no movie ratings until I turned 14 in 1968. And then suddenly, my friends and I were not allowed to buy tickets to cool movies like Easy Rider and The Wild Bunch. And ever since, I've wondered exactly what determines if a given movie is PG-13 rather than PG, or PG-13 rather than R, and so on. The documentary This Film Is Not Yet Rated a decade ago looked into this process and how ratings can make or break a movie.
I got the call and they said NC-17. That's when my blood turned to ice water.
Because the studio won't release your movie.
I'm going to say the F word. It's the fascist system.
At the time, Howard Friedkin was on the official jury of raters for the Motion Picture Association of America, the MPAA. Since then, he has turned that experience into a career. He professionally advises filmmakers on how to get the ratings they want. That is, mainly to turn R's into PG-13s, because kids can go to PGs without an adult, which means a much larger potential audience. So what Friedkin typically does for his Hollywood clients is suggest exactly how much profanity or nudity or sex or violence has to be trimmed back. Howard Friedkin, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you.
How many people are on this board?
There, in screening a film, there's 8 to 13.
Are there any written codified rules, or is it just it's what you 10 people think?
There are a few guidelines, but every film is viewed and analyzed, separately. As an example, you know, a guideline would be there's 2 F-bombs would get you into an R.
Hey! Did you touch my drum set?
Hey, knock it off!
You fucking crazy, man. You should be medicated. Fuck you, Brennan!
You could have 1 in a 13 for sure.
And I'm Ron Burgundy. Go fuck yourself, San Diego.
But the second one, you know, the F-bomb would have to be mentioned, you know, a distance away from each other, you know, a half hour after the first one said, or 20 minutes or something like that.
And what's the logic of that, of the distance?
That, again, that's the, you know, that's one of the guidelines that...
just God gave you and you obey.
Yes.
So let's talk about each of the ratings. As you say, G, that's easy. That's a cartoon. That's whatever it is. And there's nothing in there. And we're just obviously
actually,
G.
If you think about it, if you're viewing like a Roadrunner cartoon or even like Bugs Bunny.
A lot of violence.
The violence in there. Yeah. That's good. You know,
like
as
them.
A kid.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. As a kid, we couldn't get enough of it. But now it would be PG.
Interesting. So every time the coyote gets crushed by the roadrunner,
gets hit in the head or
blown
exactly,
up or fence the PG.
Especially blown. That could even maybe get it into a 13, depending on some parents. Yeah.
And then what pushes you from PG to PG-13?
Use of one F-bomb will get you into a 13.
Uh-huh.
Breast nudity.
Jack, I want you to draw me like one of your French girls, wearing this, wearing only this.
And it has to be quick, and it has to be almost maybe clinical rather than sexual. If it's purely sexual, then that's going to probably take it into an R with a discussion, depending how long it is.
What else gets you to R?
Well, a drug. Obviously, drugs will get you into an R.
Wait a minute, man. Let's smoke this fucking thing.
I can't, man. I gotta...
So, NC-17s. How many NC-17s in a year do they give these days?
Actually, when I was there, there weren't that many. Maybe five that I know of.
And what gets you there from R?
That's like full nudity and, you know, in a sexual situation, depending on, you know, what the act is and so forth.
Right.
You can't make an omelet without breaking a few eggs. For me, nymphomania was callousness.
Can violence get you to NC-17?
Oh, absolutely.
Over time, I mean, you were there from what year to what year as a Raider?
From 2000 to 13.
So that was enough time to see at least some potential change in mores. Did the board get more sensitive or more lenient in various ways over that 13 years?
Probably they allowed a little bit more in the violent content in the 13. That seemed to have changed with these superhero pictures, G.I. Joe and Iron Man.
I am Iron Man.
Really? So more violence was allowed?
Yeah, because it was characterized as cartoon violence.
I have a couple of questions about that. One is, like, these are $150 million movies. Of course we got to give them a PG-13. Was that part of it?
Without trying to get fired from the board if I was still on it.
Yes, you're not. So go. Be honest.
There might be a situation where, you know, a big tentpole picture be allowed to, flex their muscles a little bit more.
Right. How about sex versus, you say violence has become more accepted over in this century and rated more leniently. Sex, same, different?
No, nudity is much more a concern. And for some reason, the parents really, you know, they really focus on that.
Now, what about heterosexual sex versus homosexual sex?
That's a slippery slope, too.
So to speak.
You know, that still might be a little, a little stigma there.
But two women making out or two guys making out, let's say, clothed.
Right.
This is a one-shot thing we got going on here.
It's nobody's business but ours.
You know I ain't queer.
Me neither.
That's going to be, that's a PG-13?
Yeah. Again, depending on if it's just simply kissing, it'll probably maintain in a 13.
And how about, but a man and a woman doing that, that's not even going to be PG,
right? That would probably be PG.
Since the invention of the kiss, there have been five kisses that were rated the most passionate, the most pure. This one left them all behind.
Again, depending, you know, if there's tongues going wild or
right.
wagging and all that, you know.
Right,
and,
right,
yeah.
right.
Yeah, so.
What a weird job you had. But anyway, the reason this is a thing at all at this point, right, is that by and large, a movie that is rated PG-13 has the chance of selling a lot more tickets than a movie that's rated R, right? That's the key thing,
yeah, that's
right?
The rule of thumb. Yeah, exactly. And that's why I kind of like formed my my company.
So talk about that. So you've been a Raider, and like a guy who's worked for a senator, then you go and be a lobbyist, or I guess that's the equivalent, right? And so you have this firm, and producers and studios come to you and say, "So Howard, tell us what to do."
They usually holler help, yeah.
But how does that work?
Well, first I ask them what rating they're after. If they're after an R, then, you know, I tell them, hey, save your money and go put what you want into it because most likely you'll get your R.
Interesting.
If they want a 13, then yeah, then I have to go ahead and make a you know, an elaborate report.
I'm fascinated by everything about this. So I want to slow it down. So you they'll come to you with a script and you'll say, oh, take, you know, if you just want an R, don't even worry. But we're talking about PG-13, fine. Take out this, put this on page 12, and then presumably if they think you're good and they still employ you, they right. show you the film as soon as they have a rough cut?
Yeah, they'll do that. Sometimes it's a lot different on paper versus film
yep.
because depending on how they're going to shoot that bullet impacting the, you know, the person, you know, might just say on paper, you know, bullet strikes Charles or whoever the character yep. is. But in the film, you see it, you know, exploding in the chest and the blood's flying everywhere. And I tell them, you know, I warned you.
And so then you say, well, that's, you know, that's going to get you, the way that blood splatter goes onto the lens or whatever is going to get you an R. You can't do that if you expect not to get an R.
Right. And there's a couple of other, I don't want to say tricks, but there's a couple of other, you know, rather than seeing the person getting shot and the blood splattering at that point, you could just have the impact and then show the wall with the blood. You know, these little things, you know, tone it down. You could raise the music so you don't hear the, you know, the gunshot. You know, there's a whole bunch of different things right. that can be done depending on the scene.
So I want to play some clips that have examples of scenes that might have been determining factors in those movies' ratings.
Okay.
And I want to have you be our color commentator, I guess, expert commentator on these. We're going to take a look and listen to a scene from Boogie Nights, the great 1997 movie about the porn movie world. The MPAA originally gave Boogie Nights an NC-17 rating, but after a few shrewd edits, the filmmakers negotiated it down to an R. The scene we're about to play is from the final R-rated version after it had been modified to get the correct rating. Bill Macy's character, who's part of the porn world, walks in on his wife, played by Nina Hartley, having sex with somebody else.
What the fuck are you doing?
What the fuck does it look like I'm doing?
Can you close the door?
Don't stop, Big Dad.
So the director of Boogie Nights, the great Paul Thomas Anderson, said that the MPAA problem, the rating board problem, was that it was the speaking, that because they reshot it, he reshot it where they pause from actually having active humping, and she speaks, and then they return. That's what allowed him to get an R instead of an NC-17. Does that sound plausible?
Yeah. It's also the amount of thrusts or humps that's in the scene.
The number?
And yeah. It can definitely be the prolonged, you know, action of it.
Really, like, so 3 would get you an R, but 10, no way.
Yeah, something like that. And plus, the way it was framed, I believe her breasts were not completely shown. They were just kind of like right at the, I guess, the nipple margin or something.
Uh-huh.
So that might have helped as well.
Now, the King's Speech.
Yeah,
I wasn't even aware that that's an R-rated picture because I'm not a teenager and my kids are grown. But I don't think of it as a film that would have been R-rated, but it was. And maybe because of this scene, which is the moving session with his speech therapist, where King George discovers that he doesn't stammer when he curses.
You know the F word?
Fornication?
Oh, Bertie.
Fuck. Fuck! 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 Fucking fuck! Fuck! Fucking bugger! 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 Buggity! 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 Fuck.
Terrific!
Which was a
terrific.
Great scene. It was Colin Firth playing George VI and Jeffrey Rush.
Great
as the speech therapist. So they just decided, we love that scene, and probably 15-year-olds aren't going to go to this without their parents anyway, so fuck it.
Again, you can watch that film and just say, okay, so he says, you know, fuck 8-10 times, whatever
yes.
it is. But it's such a great film
yes.
and such a great, you know, meaningful, you know, performances, and you're not using it sexually. It's just to help this, you know, this guy to come to terms with his stuttering. But if I go in there rating the film based on that, then, you know, that's not, you know, that...
A parent would be surprised
right.
if you made that a PG-13 and they went and saw that scene.
Yeah, they're going to be, they're going to be taken back.
So now that any 12-year-old can watch anything he or she
right,
wants
yeah.
anytime on her
right.
computer or probably television, like, what's the point? isn't the MPAA and the ratings at this point starting to be a little quaint?
No, that's the whole key, is that I don't care what's happening in your house. I don't care what's happening down the street.
Right.
I'm rating this film according to how I think the normal parent's going to view this. And I'm just giving you the information as to what this contains.
So, you know, in your lifetime, in my lifetime, you think this will continue because parents will still want to know and they still have a basic understanding of, okay, this is what PG-13 means, this is what R means, this is what NC-17 means, and I want to know that for my kids' sake.
It's better than, you know, censorship, which, you know, obviously would take over unless something changes.
Howard Friedkin, thank you very much. This has really been a completely illuminating delight for me.
Oh, I'm glad. No, I had a great time.
Howard Friedkin is the founder of Film Rating Advisors. Coming up, best use of flute in a rock band since Jethro Tull. Tank and the Bangas, live here in our studio. That is still ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Studio 360.
The New Orleans band Tank and the Bangas first appeared on my radar earlier this year when they won NPR's big annual Tiny Desk Contest.
Down by the river where the three girls go, where the sun be burning, burning hot. Take your penny hold, don't nobody know where you go. Just know the block just got hot.
In case you don't know, the Tiny Desk Concert is a video series where bands perform at a desk in the NPR newsroom. The contest is a talent search where bands submit videos of themselves playing an original song around a desk that is not at NPR. When Tank and the Bangas won, they beat out 6,000 other entrants. Tank is the nickname of their founder and leader, Tariona Ball. And in the middle of their big summer tour, she and her crew have invaded our studio. Tank, Bangas, welcome to Studio 360.
Thanks.
Before you play and before we talk more, congratulations on winning this big Tiny Desk Concert contest at NPR. You beat out 6,000 bands?
Yes, I did. Alone, of course.
Oh my God.
Tank with no Bangas.
Oh my God.
And how did you, why did you, what made you decide to enter this?
I didn't decide at all. Actually, none of us decided. It was our manager, you know, who happens to be my best friend as well.
Really?
She pushed it constantly. She pushed it so much that she had to literally set it up like it was a gig.
Really?
Yeah.
She's earned her manager stripes.
Oh yeah, it changed our lives.
Yeah, really?
So happy for it.
And the song you entered, it's called Quick.
Yes.
And that's the song you're going to play for us first
yes.
today?
Yes. All right. Oh, na, na, na. Oh, na, na, na. What?
Make your money.
Girl, you better make that money.
Make that money.
Quick.
Real slick. Girl, I'm chilled up, weaved up, everything real slick.
Sun be burning, burning hot. You take your pantyhose, nobody know what you got. Just know the block just got hot. When you see a tree, gotta be slick, gotta be quick, gotta get for your gig, gotta get there. And I'll tell you what I'm gonna do today, cause man, I strolled up in a room.
Liquor and colors.
I met somebody's groom, that was
cute.
kiss and plaster.
Took him by the hand, I slipped him
Mickey in his pocket.
Next thing that I know, he was reaching for his wallet.
I'm on the road,
driving really fast, it takes full of gas, full of cabin.
On the radio,
he plays my song so fast, my fast like Christmas for Tigers.
Sipping on that scissor, I was leaning and rocking.
Remember Michael said he's serving that bass mix with them sirens.
Girl, no.
I gotta make a quick decision. So I have a civic door, but then I get a flashback of a recap of the night before. Life?
Hi, don't you wanna ride? Don't you wanna fly? Don't you wanna pass out? This is just like last week when I
showed up in her room. It was full of liquor and colors.
I was stumbling from my car. Notice I was plastered.
Followed me right in, he slid
Mickey in my box.
Then, next thing that I know, I was leaning, he was driving, so I
gotta make a quick decision.
Gotta get out my feelings.
See that money on the dash.
Damn, wanna go to Venice.
What you say?
Then wanna go to Venice. Girl, I don't wanna go to prison.
No
so
prison.
I cranked the car up.
That was Tank and the Bangas playing Quick. God, I love that and you guys. So, Tank, introduce all these other bangas.
Oh, that would be awesome to do. Joshua Johnson right there is on the drums. That's the MD over there. That's Norman Spence on the Moog. That is Jonathan Johnson on the bass. Merle Burkett on the keys, Albert Allenbeck on the saxophone, Angelica Jelly Joseph on the backs.
Welcome.
And Terry Hollenbeck Ball on the lead.
Ooh.
Why don't you, now that we've talked, now that you've played, come over here, sit. We'll talk to a cross-section of the Bangas. So this NPR performance got 1.5 million views, which must have looked to the rest of the world like you're an overnight success, but you guys have been playing for 6 years together?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have.
But this thing must have been like a kind of hitting the jackpot a little bit, yeah?
Yeah, it was for 6,000 people that tried out for it, for them to pick us, you know, New Orleans group, bottom of the map.
For them to pick you alone. Amazing. Just amazing. We're just glad to witness, aren't we?
God's good.
I like to see this little tension. Had there been actual consequences, like bigger venues, more X, Y, or Z? I mean, is it just beyond the thing of, oh, more people know you?
Yes. Now all the venues are sold out, you know. We're going places that we've never been before. And that's one of the most amazing parts, that people don't just say, oh, hey, you know, one member. They know everybody member, everyone names. They're screaming everyone's name.
Wow.
And it's just so cool.
That's lovely. We always on this show love hearing musicians talk about the other musicians and musics that have inspired them and shaped them. So we're going to play some songs that each have been influential to each of you three anyway. Albert, you pick this one. So this is Jethro Tull.
Jethro Tull, Fat Man.
Fat Man.
Yeah, my mom had the CD of Jethro Tull Greatest Hits, and I didn't play flute until like 3 years ago, but I was always listening to it, so it's kind of weird how it caught up to me. And like, this is the first time there's like flute, and it sounded like a medieval festival or something. I just love it.
No, I mean, I was 17 when it came out, and I thought the same thing then.
Yeah, I like the flute, and I like, they had a little tambourine or lute, or is there something in there, like a little festival? It feels like a festival, and I really liked it.
Aha, uh-huh. So it was like your own little private Renaissance fair.
Yeah, I was like, it's amazing.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, it gives you a lot of like sounds.
Yeah. So Meryl, you picked a song. We're gonna play it as well.
Ooh.
My eyes are screaming.
Right, Erica.
Cause I eat a lot of vegetables.
So do you remember hearing this song for the first time?
Yeah, that was like the time where I first started really like getting into neo soul, like Erykah Badu and, you know, all the different Jill Scotts and all those people, whatever. I was in school for jazz, so that's all I pretty much listened to. I used to be like, who wants to listen to pop music?
Oh, so you look
like
down on music. That stuff. we have another song to play. This is yours, Tank.
I don't want to go through your phone. Some things are better left unknown.
That's PJ Morton, right?
Uh-oh, all right, PJ.
I'd rather keep living in my daydream. Living in my daydream.
Y'all been looking at me crazy. I'm sorry if I'm not at the medieval fair.
That looks good. But it looks good. I'm glad you picked this.
The video's there.
But PJ Morton is a fellow New Orleansian, yeah?
Yeah, he's a Orleanian.
Orleanian.
Yeah, he's from there.
Yeah, he's from there. He is awesome, and he influenced a lot of my early listenings and stuff. I love a lot of different music, but as far as a New Orleans artist, sometimes even though we have a lot of music there, to pick PJ is a really special one.
He plays with Maroon 5.
He
well.
Does.
Huh. And that song was called Go Through Your Phone. I looked at your tour chart. I mean, you've been like really since early spring, like 6 gigs a week straight?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is that kind of insane?
Mm-hmm. It's very insane.
Yeah. We miss flights.
Yeah, do you?
We can miss some flights.
And we run. We get a lot of exercise in the airport.
We run.
Especially JFK, long ass airport.
You can say long ass. We can accept. The FCC will allow us to do that and more, I think. So world domination, I guess, is your goal, right?
Oh, my gosh. The pinky and the right. I mean, honestly, just to influence and inspire people the same way that we've been influenced and inspired to even just live out this thing, period. The fact that you can live your life off of what is already inside of you. You're a house that, you know, God made. And if you don't follow your dream, you will literally work for somebody that follow theirs. So you got to go full force in this thing.
Nicely said. Tank, Bangas, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kurt.
This was great. Will you play one more song? Play us out, that is.
All right, let's do it.
This song is Boxes and Squares.
Here we go. Tried to be a vegetable only once,
and even soup. You know I could have been. On sale.
Maybe we can buy her too.
But I heard Joe and Mama showed your buttons until you were 22. And your sister washed your laundry.
I think it's time I did laundry too. Meats, beets, greens, peas, milk, fruit, eggs, you.
Check out Tank and the Bangas on their tour this summer and fall. We link to that schedule at studio360.org, where you can also watch a video of yet another song they performed live right here in our studio. And that's it for this week's episode. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our executive producer is
Jocelyn Gonzalez.
Our senior editor is
Andrew Adam Newman.
Our technical director is
Louis Mitchell.
Our producers are
Daniel Guimet,
Sam Kim,
Skylar Swenson,
Tommy Bizzeri,
Zoe Saunders.
And our intern is
Claude Gallet.
I'm Kurt Anderson, and thank you very much for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.
The Great White Whale.
He rises!
It's been seen as the story of a fascist, the story of a totalitarian communist, and most recently, the story of a terrorist.
I'm Kurt Anderson. Join me as we chase Moby Dick, our next American icon in Studio 360.